You see, you became a dad, Chris, and all of a sudden want large text sizes.
I'm not trying to impress anybody with the font size of my phone, that's for sure.
Hey there, Shopper Maniacs! You're listening to the garbage truck driving by my house edition of Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rupert. With me is Chris Goyer.
Hey! Yep, just another one. Yeah, Dave's got a garbage truck. I got two dehumidifiers behind me that I turned off. I'm in my parents' basement. I assume most of our audience is in there.
All the success, man. Sure. And you've skyrocketed to get back
to
your
parents'
basement.
No, we're visiting family, so I brought the old broadcaster along, and we're doing it that way. So, that's great. Right. You know what I always say? What better place to talk about typography on the web than your parents' basement? That's like an old saying,
old proverb, old Jewish proverb.
So to do that, we have somebody extremely qualified to talk to us and take us through the world of web typography. Friend of the show, Tim Brown. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah.
Hey, welcome back.
We love talking about web typography anytime, and a typography of any kind, really. But this is a special occasion in a sense because we're getting the early inside scoop on a new book from Tim Brown. So Tim told me about it. I happen to be looking at a preview version of it. Sorry, audience, you can't read it yet. Only I can read it as I have special access to this book. But what's it called, Tim? What's going on?
So the book is called Flexible Typesetting, and it's going to be published by A Book Apart this summer. I'm really excited about it.
Ooh, hey, congratulations. You made the club. I have long desired to be in this club, and now I'm sitting with two you know, competent individuals who sure have written for A Book Apart. Great. This is great. This is ideal. Let's go. Let's just finish the show.
Oh, man.
Well, Tim, it was no small effort. You said this is, in some ways, have been kind of laying the groundwork for this for something like 8 years.
That's right. It's been a long time. When I was in college, I was studying graphic design and typography and teaching myself how to make websites. And and one of my professors at the time, he was like grading this printed book that I had typeset. He said, "I can't believe that you want to do web typography. What a waste." But there was always something really like interesting to me about typography on the web. And I've been trying to articulate that.
Have you what a waste? Like, where does that come? What were they saying? Like, there's just not enough possibility there, or like, it's so much more interesting to do typography other places.
Well, I mean, at the time it was 2003, web fonts were not a thing. So the you know, choices were very limited. CSS was, you know, young. CSS layouts were just becoming supported. So I understand what he meant, but there was potential there that I saw and kept trying to figure out, you know. And I think we've got it. Like, this book, I tried my best, and man, A Book Apart has such talented people helping to articulate all that stuff and clarify your thoughts. Karen Litherland edited my book. We have a couple of awesome technical editors. You know, it just, this book makes clear what I felt was interesting about type on the web for a long time.
And so it doesn't seem like it's like, here's how to use at font face. It's maybe not like a technical manual of how to approach it.
That's right. That's right. Actually, I'm really excited about this aspect of the book, is that it isn't really like other books. Like, you can put it alongside other typography books, other web books, and it's not duplicating what you've read elsewhere. Like, it fills a gap. It touches on accessibility. It touches on foundational stuff in your code, like reset style sheets and viewport settings. It talks about cleaning up text, which I haven't seen a whole lot of places talk about. Character encoding, choosing fonts, shaping text blocks. And when I talk about shaping text blocks and then shaping flexible compositions, I'm not so much talking about how to do it, how to get web fonts working, how to write the CSS to choose font sizes or widths or whatever, not how to do layout, but which measurements to choose for the numbers in all of those things that you do, and why that's important and how it's all related. That's the stuff that's really been interesting to me, because the web has changed typography. And I say this in the beginning of the book, like, this is the first, I mean, it's kind of hard to see, but this is the first time typography has ever changed like this. Always before the web, you were preparing text for static output in one way or another. Maybe there's dynamic for like TV and stuff, but it wasn't, the way that I describe it in the book is multi-dimensional, optional.
Here's a part from the book that says, take a minute to go find a physical book. Any book will do. Open it up and look at a paragraph. Ask yourself, what if this paragraph were sitting on a much narrower page? How would the paragraph need to change to look good? That's fascinating, but there's so many other questions that you get into shortly after. Like, what if the paragraph was wider instead? What if the font size were much bigger or smaller, if it was a different font? There's all kinds of questions you could ask yourself that, well, like, what if that paragraph in that physical book that you're looking at changed? What would need to change? And then you say, that's not theoretical. This paragraph will change on the web, depending on all kinds of different circumstances you might be looking at that paragraph in, from different types of screens and devices with different capabilities and such.
That's right. And it's kind of like, we all know this. I mean, it's not, when I say stuff like that part you just read, like every designer working on the web, every developer, you understand that your stuff's going to flex and change. It's just that, like, stepping back and articulating, point by point, all the decisions that you could and feel like maybe you should make about that flexibility is really overwhelming. And I want to use this book to try and help people understand how much work is actually involved in making really good looking websites.
And so part of it is, you can talk about it abstractly because you kind of have to some degree, but also to really make this click in people's mind, you got to show examples and stuff. So that's a kind of a neat thing that you do in here too, is be like, well, here's a real website. So let's look at that one and build it and make the choices based on this kind of real world situation. So I think hopefully that will click with some people. Another, possible part that will help people understand this, or the difference between, I guess, what typography was and what it's becoming, is that our sentences, we used to view web or typography as a set of fixed decisions, but now we understand it as a continuum of conditional logic. So that's tricky too, is that you can tell somebody like, well, in this situation and with this font, 15 pixels looks good, I guess, but that's just one part of a million decisions you're going to have to make. Right? There's no way to, there's no like font size, make it look right
or right.
Something.
Yeah. Well, even if like you were typesetting a book in ye olde times, you had maybe like two or three fonts in your big old brick of fonts that you would choose and typeset like manually or whatever. But now it's I have 150 fonts that I pirated inside my dropdown, in my fonts dropdown. Or, or Google Fonts has a million fonts and it's one line of CSS or HTML to put it all on my page. And, the choices are incredible. And then like you compare the like heart and soul between two fonts and you're just like, this can be radically different, it just changes the whole mood and impression. I remember early in my days of development, I read a book about web design and it was all just about colors, like the colors you pick and like inform the mood and the trustworthiness of the site. And I just was like, Wow, that's amazing that colors can do that. But type is that times 10, really.
Yeah, it's a fundamental ingredient. And I think that type is also really interesting because, I mean, we've always talked about, and layout's getting better on the web, feeling more natural, especially with CSS Grid and Flexbox. Like, those are really interesting. But we've always thought about websites as boxes, right? CSS has the box model. And you shape these boxes, and then into those boxes, you pour the text. And the problem with that is that there's relationships inside text blocks among the measurements you choose. And as boxes flex, they put pressure on those relationships. Spaces inside the text block start to feel wrong. Spaces between different text objects start to feel wrong. And if you this book is not going to tell anybody, any reader, like new challenge you to learn something, like make you learn something new, that like an additional thing to have to do at your job. But it might change your mind about the work that you're already doing. Like if you design your text blocks and then let the relationships inside them shape your layouts, then you just end up with better looking layouts.
I'm trying to think of, I like the way that was set up, you know, like you have a div or something and you blast some P's in that div. And so now you have some text and you're looking at it in one particular situation and you make some CSS choices that make it look right. And what those choices are, well, let's assume you've already chosen a typeface. So that's happening. But you're like, well, I definitely need to size it. So let me pick the right font size. I definitely need to pick a line height too, because that's a part of the equation. And probably some margins and paddings and stuff around it to make sure that the block is okay. Let's probably like set some max width type stuff going on so that just in case this container is, say, almost as large as the browser window is, that things don't get too crazy line length wise. That's three that I can think of, three or four, however you want to interpret what I just said. Is that most of them, a handful of them? And then the idea is that, like, that, let's say that it squishes down and that container gets a lot narrower than it was. Those, even though I made, let's say, the perfect choices in one situation, those perfect choices become wrong. Right. So what we have in our toolbox is a media query, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we have a little more than just media queries. We have CSS Calc helps us. Min and max, range rules help us. I think that we need more of that kind of stuff. But essentially what you're talking about is what I'm talking about as chapter four of the book, especially shaping text blocks. There are just a few properties that you pay attention to, but whereas traditionally people have chosen values for those things. This is my font. This is my font size. This is my width. This is my line spacing. For every value, margins, you now have to choose minimums and maximums. And CSS doesn't even let you do all that yet, but that's what needs to exist in order for flexible compositions to feel as good as the best printed typography has always felt.
Yeah, otherwise you're just kind of battling, right? You're just kind of like, you know, you want it to scale a bit, but not over scale and not under scale. And I dealt with that. My blog is probably a textbook case of how not to typeset your site. But I've struggled with the like H1, you know, like I want it big and I want it beefy. I just want you to be like, oh man, this guy knows what he's talking about. He puts, you know, big headings on his website, but it looks amazing on a 34 inch wide monitor. But then, you know, it just never works, or it's too big, you know, or I only have like two words on a line and that's just like, that bothers me. And then like, when I launched my redesign, somebody was like, 17 pixel body size, huh? That's, you know, interesting. I was like, yeah, I like was feeling it. And then like, the more I like checked it on my phone and whatever, I was like, 16 pixels. So I changed it to 16 pixels. And then all of a sudden my characters per line on my paragraphs is now like double, or like 10% more or something. Yeah. And so I was like, oh man. So I have to now fix the containers on my site.
It's all related. And then I like,
And then I do that little thing where you like, you make images a little wider than the paragraph block, you know, which I still like, but I can very quickly like see like, well, I'm just introducing a bunch of like scan, like my rag, like the edge, the left rag, I guess is what it's called in type, is all messed up now because I have like media and code blocks and text snippets like popping out. And so now that maybe is a problem, you know, what am I going to do? So
that's an interesting problem that you just brought up about different sorts of text blocks, especially for blogs like yours. You guys were talking about this on a previous show with where code samples, right? Sections of code samples look better wider. And so a lot of documentation tends to have really long line lengths. I don't think there's a right or wrong way to go about that sort of problem. I think that it hasn't really, I mean, maybe textbooks in the past were the sort of place where this challenge would show up. And as you guys noted, some of those are really hard to read because of those line lengths. I think that varying the rag, like you just talked about, Dave, where some elements are wide and some are more narrow, is a reasonable solution for a blog. And these new CSS layout possibilities that we have for positioning blocks of content in more interesting ways are going to make the solutions better, right? You can fill spots in like sidebars more easily. And maybe there'll be ways to scroll or, you know, people will experiment with ways of dealing with long code blocks.
Yeah, no, I mean, I could see like keeping a left, like all paragraphs go from grid, you know, span 2 to 7, and then codes or pre-blocks go from 2 to 12 or, you know, 13, whatever. It's kind of like, I could see that kind of being, try to keep that rag and then give things more room. But then, but, you know, it's always like, what's your style? I don't know.
Yep.
That's tough to always imagine all the scenarios. So
that header one is funny to me that, you know, it's so tempting to have big bold, or and not bold is the wrong word because it has typographic meaning, I guess, but big, you
beefy,
know, like
beefy.
Yeah, just large, I guess. Headers that make perfect sense and work fine on large screens and then are obviously way too big at small screens. So and then the second you write a line of code that says like, oh, media query, small screen, make H1 smaller, you're like, oh, that's such a one-off choice, you know? Like, that's not really, I shouldn't be writing this one line of code. I probably should be writing like a whole system that scales down all of my headers like the same amount or based on some calculation or something.
Right.
And then it's like, well, how exactly do I do that? Because it seems like, okay, at some screen, my H1s are like 60% bigger than my H2s, but they can't, that ratio can't maintain itself on a small screen. Really, headers are probably 5% bigger or 10% bigger than each other. So it's like, oh, even that is like blows my mind. Like the relationship between the sizes even has to change it.
Yes. Okay. So that word you just used, I think, is really important. The relationships. So there's two super interesting things about what you guys were just talking about. One is relationships among elements, especially how that relates to compositional contrast and spacing. And the idea that you can't see everything. Like, you are deciding about that H1 because you happen to set it one way, look at it in a different situation, and see it that way, right? There are situations aside from those, obviously, that you just haven't seen yet, or you're just making assumptions about. This is why device labs are popular, why, you know, screenshot services are popular. And design tools aren't helping us with this sort of stuff as much as they should be. Like, I should be able to have a design tool that puts me in, like, an immersive environment that shows me all kinds of permutations on the design decision I just made and warns me about things that are getting out of whack over here or over there. I'm really interested in helping tools do that sort of stuff with typographic limits. And the relationships are the thing that that I don't know about. They're the you know the CSS locks stuff that we've been thinking about for a little while, and just the idea of putting limits around a flexible decision. And having the behavior change outside of those limits, right?
So I guess for people that haven't heard of that term, it means that you kind of have, you use a calculation for a setting instead of just a setting. So instead of saying 16 pixels or 24 pixels, maybe you express, like, I want this number to be between 16 and 24 pixels based on this calculation. But the lock part of it is, but no smaller than 16 pixels and no larger than 24 pixels. So there's locks on either side of it.
Right, right. And the analogy that I like about that word locks is waterway locks, right? That raise and lower ships to different water levels. Within that lock, it's a flexible value. But and so that's interesting, but it's still about individual elements. And I think where I would like to see CSS go is to provide a way for us to establish relationships among elements. To have that lock depend not just on, you know, properties of the element that you're making flex, but maybe have it relate to some other element's values so that you can adjust, let's say, the font size of one element depending on how wide some other element is or how wide the container is. Maybe the sort of element or container query stuff, I'm not all brushed up on the latest in that area, but I mean, this is what I don't know about. I just feel like dynamic relationships are what's going to be the final missing piece for you know, typography in CSS.
Right. That seems, wow. You know, like, I don't, to set a line length based on some other element's width is fascinating and, you know, at the moment, definitely JavaScript territory of some kind. There's definitely no CSS way to express that, I would think. But, you know, is this what Houdini is all about? Is this what it was designed to do? Maybe, you know.
Maybe.
I don't know how much you know about that, but it seems like that's kind of the point, is that you could write your own function. So you would probably write it as, you know, I don't know, custom line height parentheses. And then tell it, give it a CSS selector of some other element to watch and which property to watch or something. But I don't know, because it's almost like you don't want it in JavaScript, right? Because there's this inherent problem of writing something like this in JavaScript, is the idea is it lays itself out and you probably have asynchronous JavaScript and then it evaluates and then makes a new styling choice. And then you all of a sudden you have flash of wrong line height text. We need like a new weird acronym for that one.
Yeah. I think the example I gave a few minutes ago about font size and width is not the best one. The best example of this would be line height and margins, right? Those are two white space components of a text block that should
relate. And you mean, so like line height, the white pixels between two lines of text that are overflowing, and then margins like between two paragraphs, right?
Right. That's or even margins on the left and the right of a paragraph. So
Right.
So like those white spaces should relate. If the line space loosens up, the margins should loosen up as well. There's a type designer named Cyrus Highsmith who talks about this. He calls it tempo, the tempo of a text, where when you have something like a narrow column, let's say of news or tweets or something, you want to tighten up the tempo. It's faster. Right? So all of the white space gets a little bit more condensed. Margins, line spacing, word spacing, letter spacing, everything tightens up a little bit. Whereas if you have a lot of room and you want to fill it out in an elegant way, you loosen the tempo. You have a wider measure, looser line spacing.
Well, I don't know why anybody would argue against you on something like this mattering, but it could be said that, like, you have the tools. So if you want that to happen, use CSS to do it.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the problem with that is that, I mean, you're probably right, and maybe CSS will never get to the point that I'm hoping it will get to. Sorry, a motorcycle just went by here. but the way I think about web design is that we need to be teaching our work to think the way we think. And if I have to establish all of these, you know, rules about flexibility of a composition in independent ways, then that's, you know, they're disconnected from one another. And that's not the way that I intend for the composition to behave. And I know this is very abstract, but this is why the web is so interesting to me. It's like we have the ability to argue for this way and demonstrate why it's valuable. So you know, in the short term, yeah, we could do it with independent calc equations and media queries and stuff, and maybe put together the sort of example that shows why coding it that way is just way too much work. I think there maybe are two directions toward the future of this stuff, and one is CSS and standards and standardizing that kind of relationships among values and behaviors, and the other future direction is tooling. When you think about those two issues I mentioned a few minutes ago, the idea of seeing all of what you're doing, and the idea of having to articulate all of these little decisions about the whole composition and how things relate to other things, like, that's overwhelming. Tools should not only help us to see all those decisions, but they should make all those decisions for us in a default way and then let us tweak those things or let us adjust all of those things in one shot with like preferences. Like this is why I'm super interested to work where I work. Like I have the ability to talk with people who make design tools all the time. And you know, you got to think about the audience and the business, and there's definitely stuff I'm talking about that nobody's really ready for, but it's exciting to have the opportunity to talk about those things.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by An Event Apart. I feel all warm and fuzzy inside when I think about Event Apart. It's my favorite conference series. I've been to a whole bunch of them, and I love it every time I get to go, partly because it's a community and I see friendly faces I know, and partly because the conference is just so well done. I know it's just going to be fantastic. There's going to be good food and good Wi-Fi, and it's going to be comfortable, and the party's going to be fun, and the extra events are going to be fun. And then a big deal part of it is just that all the talks and the speakers that they get are just incredible and polished, and the days just roll by because you just get engrossed in the talks, and it's so cool. It's interesting to think about that. Event Apart's been a while, you know, in the history of the web. It's most of it, I guess. And they kind of pioneered the single track multi-discipline conference event, meaning like everybody at the event sees the same stuff. So you're sitting at lunch with somebody, you know, which talk did you like the best? You all saw it, so that conversation makes a lot of sense. It's great. They're the first to do this, still the best. The days are, you know, they're 2 or 3 day events, and they're in different cities all throughout, you know, the United States. So pick one that's nearest you or furthest away from you if you feel like flying to it or whatever you want to do there. So an Event Apart is where the most important developments in user-focused, standard-based web and interaction design get their start, from responsive web design to mobile-first, from web fonts to typography to intrinsic web design. You hear it first at Event Apart. So check that out for sure. Go to eventapart.com and eventapart.com. And if you sign up for one of them, for any of these 2-day, 3-day things, the coupon code AEACP, like CodePen, because we're, you know, working together with them at Shop Talk and CodePen and CSS Tricks and everywhere, AEACP is good for $100 off any event through the year. So that's pretty cool. So it's just a wonderful event, and I hope you go and enjoy it and love it like I do.
Have you ever heard of the term heading ramp or something like that?
Yeah.
It's basically like at mobile, you have this size, at desktop or tablet, you have this size, and, you know, but you do that like, let's say three heading sizes, and then you do that for six different types of headings, and you just, like, it becomes this, like, document. You're just like, I don't know, and then I don't even know which one that is at this point. I don't think in Photoshop or anything, like, right now, you can be like, this is an H1, so, like, use that symbol across everything. Maybe XD has, like, symbols or something of that nature. Then, like, Sketch has that. But, like, it seems like you don't really get a way to be like, okay, just show me all the headings and all the ramps, you know? And again, I think what you're kind of even saying is like, what if we got out of the ramp game entirely and we just said small value, large value, a little math to size it. And that's what I would really like personally. Just cause it's kind of makes more sense. Like, I don't know. That's the thing, right? Like, typography historically has been so controlled. This machine will print out this at this in this exact color, you know, using this Pantone. And now it's just like, who knows, like what it's going to be, but let's just hope it all hits the, all goes fast, I guess. I don't know. Yeah.
Is it a second design system? I mean, design systems are so hot, you know, and I know they mean different things to different people, but I guess I'm mostly picturing of like a pattern library where like this is our tabs and this is our accordion and this is some other module component kind of thing. Type is like it almost feels like a, if you see it in design systems, it's like, here's our headers, that's it,
right?
You know, or something, you know, it's always like it's definitely not comprehensive,
right?
Yeah,
right. There just needs to be more, we need to make more decisions about how the type is behaving. And, you know, this is also why conversational design tools are so popular right now, because there are a lot of things about the way websites have to behave as they flex that design decisions were not made about. And then the developer has to just deal with it. And either the developer makes decisions and then the designer might be unhappy with them and then they have to talk about it, or the developer then has to ask the designer, well, how did you want this type to behave when this gets into these conditions over here? And this is why you have, right, like review modes and, you know, multiple people with cursors on a piece of code looking things over.
I guess we can say like, oh, it sucks that there's not enough tools for this and there's not a design tools aren't helping as much. And there's all kinds of things that like could be a lot better. And specifically relationships we mentioned were kind of a problem. It's a little hard to express that. And it's a little hard to express like looking at like when you make a choice, a typographic choice, it would be nice if it's almost like we were alerted to problems that might cause, or like, okay, you changed it here, but this is how it's going to affect it here, 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 and here. Did you think about that? Or like a design tool that exposes that. That seems great. But just to pin that for a minute, there is all kinds of like interesting things people can do now with the tools we have now that are set up these relationships and kind of do as good of a job as possible now, right? It's not like we're in some dark ages of typographic impossibility.
We're sure better off than we were a few years ago. Yeah. But I think that code is really the way to go right now. I mean, this is why I use CodePen when I make all of my design decisions, because code is where you can articulate these things most easily. And
that's funny that because it's not the last step in this case. Like, code is the design tool at the moment, because
Well,
and not to FUD everybody, fear, uncertainty, death, but like variable fonts coming into the scene, so much more to deal with. I have to go to Axis Praxis just to even understand what I might do and how I might manipulate a font. And then you don't even know if your font has those manipulators, you know, until like you read some documentation. And so that's all to say it's about to get really wild. Like the configuration of text is about to get like just wild. I'll be using one font file, hopefully, and that's going to be wonderful, but it's just not going to make it necessarily easier. So,
yeah. So So variable fonts are an interesting thing to talk about here. And I loved your episode with Jason Palmenthal a few weeks ago, where he talked about variable fonts. Variable fonts are like a microcosm of what I'm talking about in this book. Variable fonts are something that people can see, move, and change, and it's just a typeface. So you're looking at a few characters or, you know, a string, and it can get condensed or it can get more bold. And that's what happens with your entire website. It's just that with your entire website, font sizes are changing, line spacing is changing, margins are changing, and, you know, heading sizes, that ramp that you talked about, that's changing. Just like a variable font changes. And so I think that if you think about typesetting as a thing that we've always been doing as we make websites, and the sort of flexibility that's inherent in all of those decisions, whether we're caring to make them or not, variable fonts fit right in. The other thing I wanted to say about variable fonts is that, like, everything that we've talked about on this episode can feel a little overwhelming, and variable fonts certainly feel overwhelming. I think the way to approach all of that to make it less overwhelming is to think about the jobs that you're doing with type in your website. And that's how I lead chapter 3 in the book about font selection. This book is really, I mean, it's called Flexible Typesetting, but I start off in the book by saying that typesetting is just one part of typography. So there's, you know, this illustration that I made, a wheel of different jobs that type does. Body text is one job. Display text is one job. Signage and UI is different. All these different jobs that type does. If you know that a chunk of text is doing a certain job, then you prioritize different aspects of its flexibility. Body text, you largely keep it the same size that it is, and you let other aspects of the text blocks flex, like measure and line spacing. Whereas if you have something like display text, which is very, you know, flashy, eye-catching, you might have that scale. Its size might flex, but its measure might stay the same because it's, you know, up in this area with artwork or photography, or, you know, and you want it to stay at, you know, you want it to scale with those things and keep its shape. So there's all kinds of different considerations that you can more easily make if you know that job. And variable fonts go along with that, right? If you know that the job of your text is for reading, it's body text, and you know you want to use a variable font, then adjusting the variable font from its starting point to make it a little bit more condensed, a little bit wider, a little bit taller in its X height so that it's visible at smaller sizes more clearly. You know, those are all subtle adjustments that you make to your composition with the tools that we have available, like CSS locks and media queries. It's all about subtle tweaks like that. But, like Dave, you mentioned variable fonts and all the crazy things they can do. Like, you're not going to do that crazy stuff with body text. You're going to do that crazy stuff with big, splashy display text or with ads. So if you know that the type is doing those jobs, you know, it's here to catch people's attention, well, then you look for variable fonts that have features that are very eye-catching. Or you think about ways of making variable fonts adjust themselves to achieve certain graphic effects that you're after. Like,
yeah, and I can even see that, like, you know, based on the number of characters, do this, you know, or based on the number of, you know, like, go really tall and narrow, or go really wide and fat, or, you know, like, there's so many, just, you can now programmatically control a typeface with JavaScript or CSS variables or whatever. That's going to be a really different world.
So, yeah, totally.
I know, like, some people, like, is it Mandy Michael? She's very much experimenting in this angle. And so that's very cool. But yeah, I just think we're at the tip of the iceberg for how you can do it at scale too. Like, how does Slate or whoever, you know, manage their brand and vibe with these, you know, new tools.
Yep. So, yep. Really interesting when you start to think about like variable fonts as, you know, entities that you can shape, right, according to their parameters, but also entities that you can animate. You think about color fonts as a thing. I know you've been thinking about that as well. Imagine a color variable font. I mean, these things aren't far off. These are going to be tools that we have available to us. It's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, it should be pretty neat. Have you even heard people like say, like, we need the ability to have like custom emoji, like, so like my brand's emoji or whatever on my website?
Yeah.
That's maybe super overkill, but I'd be interested. So
lots of companies already do that, don't they? They just use PNGs.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I guess Twitter does, right? On their little thing.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by LogRocket, which is like for creating the perfect front-end bug report. It's like every error that happens is shown in the context of the user that experienced that error with a full video replay. It's like you reproduce an issue and can see it happen as if it happened in your own browser. You do look at it in your own browser. So you're like, watch a video replay. It helps you understand what the user did to trigger that bug. So it's like zero mystery involved when a bug happens, and which is kind of not always perfectly evident in an original bug report. So it basically, they instrument the DOM to record the HTML and CSS on the page, recreating the pixel perfect video of like what happened in it. But in addition, they record like console logs, JavaScript errors, the stack trace, all the network requests and responses that happen with a header and the body and all that, browser metadata, all the stuff. So there's everything you need to figure out not only an error happened, what did it look like? Like, can, you know, because sometimes an error gets triggered and that sucks and you should fix that. But like, now you'll know for sure, did it actually impact that user and their user experience of using your site or not? Did it just kind of like happen, some kind of error happened, but it didn't really like stop the user from being what they were able to do? So that's just a big deal. That's just pretty cool. So that's what LogRocket does, the perfect front-end bug report. So it's logrocket.com/shoptalk to check it out, compare it to other tools out there if you'd like to. There's lots to learn about it. Pretty powerful, pretty cool. You can get started for free. Thanks, LogRocket. So what's like a tour of things we can already do, though, in a case? Because we mentioned CSS locks. That's an interesting tool that isn't just, it's a CSS technique, but it's just kind of one of them, right? So maybe like a tour of somebody trying to set up these relationships and doing interesting things. And I know we're probably mostly talking about body copy here, but let's say that's the job we're asking type to do. We could set up a lock for our line height and set up a lock for our font size. Are those some of the kind of the cooler, more interesting, newer things that is happening in body copy land?
Yeah, well, I think the cool new stuff would be applying those flexible mechanisms like locks to variable fonts in addition to all the normal text block settings.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So if you can make the measure of a text block, which is its width, right, if you can make that a little more narrow as the viewport gets narrow, think about also condensing the variable font just a little bit. Like adding those things up amounts to very subtle visual differences that just make your work look really refined. I think that those applying that kind of relationships and flexible rules in a composition is probably the most advanced stuff that we can do right now. But I think that there's a lot of ground to cover. There's a lot that we can improve about every website by thinking about like super fundamental stuff and just making the right decisions for readers, right? One of the things that I talk about in the book is just choosing a font size. Like, what's a good font size? Dave, you were talking earlier on the show about 17 pixels or whatever. Is pixels even the right unit to use? I have a whole like 15 pages in this book about how to exactly choose your body text font size. And there's some super nerdy stuff in there. Like, you know, part of what makes a good text font size is how comfortable people are reading it, how familiar it is to them. So maybe you should choose your type size based on what people might be most familiar with. People have been reading the core web fonts for many years, and those core web fonts are certain sizes, you know. And by core web fonts, I'm talking about the stuff that Microsoft put out years and years ago, Verdana, Georgia, Times, Helvetica, Arial. Not Helvetica. Verdana, Georgia, Times, Arial, right? Those are still fairly prevalent, and people are so used to seeing them after years and years and years. Web fonts, by comparison, are pretty new. And so when you've got a web font that really speaks to your brand, what's a good size for that? Try and get it in the range that people have grown comfortable to.
No, that's kind of reminds me, what is it? Jacob Nielsen's law of internet user experience or whatever. Just kind of like you're no website is an island. You're kind of, we're all connected in how people browse from site to site. So
right.
If you like, there's benefits in being standouty, but there's benefits in towing the line and not reinventing body copy, for example.
Yeah. So. that's a tricky balance, but yeah, that's one of the big challenges. Yeah.
No,
but also, like, you know, use relative font sizes. That is a huge, that's a huge deal from like a designer typographer perspective for folks who have always worked in print. Let's say this is one of the things that's been most challenging about the web, is that some person could have a default font size that they like, or a device they're using that comes with a font size that's very different than you think looks good as the designer. But that's okay. That's what the web is. You have to size type relative to every given reader. And however that looks when it's when it comes through is correct.
Yeah. I was shocked hanging out with my parents and my in-laws, and like what the like 60s crowd does is they hang out, pull out their iPhones and show each other how to get larger text on their iPhones. like that, it's like a party, like, hey, we're going into accessibility and zooming up, everybody. And like, they all love it. And they all say, oh, thank God. Cause I couldn't read text.
Thank God.
Like, you know,
of course.
And it's just like, and you're just like, all right, okay, this is real. These people, you know, they are consumers. They have more money than I do, these people, you know. And so you're just like, okay, this is like important.
And it's life-changing for people to be able to customize what they read all the time. People never could do that with printed materials. You know, the user preferences are the new magnifying glass. People just can get comfortable with a thing and they want it the way that they want it.
Yeah, or even like a, like, yeah, like readers, right? Like, I don't know. All my elders have readers, like little glasses they put on at restaurants and stuff. And it's dorky, but it's like, heck yeah, you know. But like the phone, you can control that. Or, you know, I have the Kindle too, right?
And I just Kindle, did it right now in front of my eyes. I blasted up the side. Not, I have an iPhone, and I didn't go like all the way super gigantic, but I blasted up quite a bit. I'm already like, oh, this is nice.
Feeling it. See, you became a dad, Chris, and all of a sudden want large
text.
I'm not
trying to impress anybody with the font size of my phone, that's for sure.
No, it's wild, right? I mean, but like, and you watch, you know, there's generations literally of people who are just like, well, I'm going to beef that up. And you don't control that. You're not in charge anymore. You lost control. So
that's right. And the way that I think about that is that readers are participating. Right? It's not that you don't have control, it's that the sort of control you have is relative. So you have to you have to put rules in place in your work to respond to those conditions. I mean, responsive web design, right? Like this is what design tools need to help us do, is put the conditions in place rather than make decisions.
Yeah, it's like a, you know, it's weird. It's like a microcosm of responsive design in that it's like, yeah, we're just focusing on making the type really responsive. But because type is such a core part of any website, it's also like it's a whole other thing. Like it's like another.
Yeah, yeah. So the way that I've thought about what you just said is that type as a building block is the new viewport dimensions. You know, like if you open up Photoshop, is it new Canvas dimensions, right? You open up Photoshop, yeah, yeah. Even open up XD, you open up design software, the first choice they make you make is the Canvas dimensions. And
that always gets right? me, like, dude. I don't know.
The choice you should make 100. First, like choose your type size. And now you've set a relative building block that everything else is oriented by. Like that's the sort of design environment that I want to see. That's why code is way more comfortable for me right now.
Because it kind of is that wrapping canvas that just you just set text parameters to. Yeah. No.
It's funny that in a sense that I don't know, browsers make some typographic choices for us. And I know 99% of us change those typographic choices because we don't want whatever it is. What's the default Times New Roman, I guess. And like, but they, you know, they have a font size that they apply to H1s through H6s. And there's some other stuff they do. They'll indent your DDs and whatever they do. But one thing that, you know, and you think that they would do that because, I don't know, because there's some web documents that exist out there on the web that benefit from because they're just semantic markup, but still you should be able to read it, you know, you should be fine. But there's a bunch of choices they don't make that are pretty bad inhibitions of readability, which I wonder if that will change it at any point. But one that always gets me, this is like my least favorite typographic mistake, is the line length mistake. When somebody's just line length is too long, or they just don't set any kind of maximum at all, and it's just like three times as long as it needs to be, or, you know, even if it's 1.5 times longer than it should be, it's still just like ugh.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I wonder if that should be part of the user agent style sheet or whatever. But it makes me think, like, what's the easiest bad mistake to make with typography.
I like that one. That's a good one. Line length. If people were able to control their line length on a more regular basis, the web would be a nicer looking place. And I think that something that I say in the book about that is that there's a lot of people love that character count rule from Bringhurst, right? 45 to 75 characters per line. And that's good, but you learn a lot about the balance in text blocks, and you develop your own skills by just changing the width of a text block and seeing how it feels and doing it again and again and comparing it to...
That's the real, you know, that's choices. What people actually do, right? You just look at it and see right? if it looks all right. And
yeah, like that's what it is. You're practicing typography. And you don't have to have gone to design school. And you don't...
You make that point in the book, is that you're probably, a lot of us are typographers already, just because we're already making all these choices. So, boom,
you are.
Typographers.
And there's no right choice, right? Things will feel definitely wrong to you, like those really long line lengths you were talking about, Chris. A lot of us, you know, everybody can feel when those are really too long. So,
that's interesting. So it's more about fixing what's wrong, what's definitely wrong, than picking what's perfectly right.
And that's,
there is no right.
And that's how I tell people to practice, right? If you're trying to decide on a line length, break it and then fix it. Make it wrong and then bring it back little by little until it starts to feel okay again. Do that repeatedly and compare the results that you come up with that you were happy about to see which one makes you most happy. Every condition of a text block, every condition of a composition, how close one column is to another column in a layout, right? Break it and then fix it. Bring it back together little by little.
Sure, sure. And then hopefully, yeah, and then I guess evaluate what kind of system you end up with, because I guess if you just fixed one off little, if you did that same kind of thing with every choice on an entire website, you might have a mess, you know, you might have a zillion little one-off media queries of pain, you know, and then be like, totally. How can I systemize that?
So this is, I get into this a little bit in chapter six of the book, and chapter six explains that the book is kind of a recursive format, so that when you're at chapter six, you've got this whole composition that you've made a lot of isolated decisions about. You have to think about how it all fits together and what to massage to make it feel coherent. And so you evaluate different pressures that you notice. And if a pressure has to do with a certain thing that we covered in a previous chapter, you sort of go back down the ladder to that chapter, fix something, and go back. You work your way back up to, you know, the top of the ladder, chapter six, where you're evaluating again. And so, for example, this is why changing the font in use on a website is such a dramatic thing that feels like it requires a lot of other little adjustments, because it's pretty fundamental to the balance in your text blocks, and the balance in your text blocks is fundamental to your composition.
Like if I just went to my website and be like, oh, I'm going to, my body copy is this, I'm just going to change it to that. That you can't just do that, right?
And you have to make all kinds of other little adjustments to get it to feel right again. That's why when people start out with a WordPress theme, right? They pick a nice looking theme, but they want to make it their own. So they choose a different font. I've done this. I'm sure you guys have done this. You pick the different font. Everything looks bad. It was a nice looking font, right? People said this font was awesome. And it looks really like you have to do all kinds of work now to get it to look good.
I'm having that experience right now in a way. It's because I spun up a new WordPress site, you know, and I just like this. I want this to be like the lowest effort thing ever, you know. That's kind of how I operate a lot of times these days. And I used, I think it's the 2015 theme or something. It just looked like the most like typographically simple of all the choices, you know. And I didn't change the font because I think I had that in the back of my mind. I just knew it. If I'm like, oh, what's hot right now? Let me just pick some other font that's just to make it like look a little bit less like a default theme and more like something me, I guess. But I knew it as soon as you can't just up and change a font. Are you kidding me? It's gonna unlock a corridor.
The scenario you're talking about there, though, is so common. Like even people who know what they're doing and can put such care into their work, you just need to get a project out the door real quick sometimes, a throwaway project. I think you wrote about this sort of thing on CSS Tricks at one point, Chris, right? You have projects like a Don't Overthink It Grids is your post that I'm thinking of, right? There are projects where you just need to make some easy, good decisions. And there's a lot of fertile ground for making easy, good decisions with design tools and code defaults, especially related to like swapping in a new font, right? Something that I'm super interested in at the moment. This is not really talked about in the book a little bit, but it's what I'm thinking about at work, is font metrics, right? Fonts have measurements about them. X height, the height of lowercase letters, right? Extenders, how high or low lowercase letters that extend past the baseline or cap height go. Right, those measurements can help you match one font up to another font. If you knew about those measurements, if the design tool helped you adjust other stuff about your typesetting because you've changed the font and it knows the metrics of that font, then swapping in a new font might not be as dramatic a change. Maybe it matches up the X height to the previous font. I mean, there's still stuff you have to think about, but like, you know, defaults could make projects much, much easier to get started. And I think that would help a lot of people.
That's Style Matcher. Have you seen that tool?
Yes.
Which is the kind of the point of it is like, look, you can pick two different fonts, and if you mess with their letter spacing and word spacing and font size and stuff, you can get them looking closer to each other than... is if you just change the font size, they can be really, really, really different. But even between two fonts, if you fool around with their little settings, you can get them looking more similar to each other. And I think the point of this is you could use one of those chunks of CSS to be pre-loading of the custom font. and then one of them after the custom font is loaded, thus like really minimizing the reflow and the, yep, you know, what it looks like when the font actually loads, which is cool, but it makes, you know, it's could use these chunks of CSS for anything here.
Yep. I talked about that in chapter 4. So like having all of these styles that you've carefully tuned to your intended web font, think about fallbacks, right? Fallbacks are a big part of this book because a lot of people don't design for those situations, and you're doing a lot of readers a disservice by not thinking about fallback styles, not just fallback fonts, but fallback typography.
I mean, you have to talk about it because it's unbelievable to me how quickly we went from browsers that barely support custom fonts at all to, oh, custom fonts are here. Now every single website on earth uses them. You know, it was a complete takeover with custom fonts. It's just unbelievable. And the pushback to that has been fairly minimal. I know we talk in this industry about font loading and font performance and fallbacks and fout and all. I mean, there's lots to talk about, but it doesn't mean that there's been a whole lot of people just being like, ah, screw it, we're not going to use them. It's been very much like, no, we're still using them. We're just going to do whatever we need.
We're using them. We just know they're really bad for performance.
No. So if anyone listening to this has not read Bromstein's Web Font Handbook, go check that out because it's awesome. That I was talking with Brom years ago about writing this book that I just got finished writing, and we talked about him writing this web font handbook so that I didn't have to write about any of that stuff as well. Like, have his web font handbook be about like how do you get these working and how do you get these performance, you know, issues sorted out. Have a strategy. Get your licensing worked out, right? Think about all that stuff. And then I could just lean on that. It's been awesome. He's made a great thing there. And the reason people go for custom type their sites is because it's, think about it, like type is an aesthetic element that flexes the way that text flexes on websites. It goes everywhere. It's not like a, you know, and it's not as heavy as an image or a video. It's really a brand element that, like color, fits in a lot of different places.
Yeah, on the Brad Frost scale of things, it's an atom, you know, yep, like that. It and if you change an atom, the whole thing changes. Like the everything now changes, and it's such a powerful thing. Well, I think we should wrap up because we are at time. But Tim, I want to say thank you. You've provided so much help here and over the years for myself and Paravel and all your type expertise. So we really appreciate that. For people who are not following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Okay, so follow A Book Apart and follow me on Twitter as Typesetting. I just changed my Twitter handle. Used to be Nice Web Type. Now it's Typesetting. And stay tuned for this summer when the book will be released.
And I look forward to Twitch spinoff of this show called Unsolicited Type, where we jump in Web Inspector and fix people's type on their websites. So look for that in 2019
nice,
or something.
Nice. Count me in.
We'll do it. Yeah, we'll do a spinoff project where we bust people's types. So I think that's going to do it for us. Thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star our favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tons of tweets a month. If you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.